Karen Atkins. Time for another monster chiller horror theater. Oh, oh, oh. And tonight, we really have a frightening movie for you tonight, kids. This is really going to be scary. I'm not kidding you this time. This movie is called Blood-Sucking Monkeys from West Mifflin, Pennsylvania. And it's really good, so I'm not going to waste any more time. Let's take a look at this movie. It's really going to scare the daylights out of you. Ooh! Let's take a look at the film. Problem, kids. The movie is we don't have the movie. Something went wrong. We don't have the film. And it was scary. I promise you, it was a real frightening film. This movie won the Western Pennsylvania Fright Award in 1978, I think. It really garnered the awards at that ceremony.
Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of Pod Stallions, the podcast for the website PladStallions.com. I am your host, the one that sounds like Seth Rogen, apparently, and to my left in Los Angeles, California, is the one that sounds like Mark Hamill. Is that what you're getting?
I have heard that. I've heard, yeah. Mark Hamill and a young Joseph Cotton.
Ooh, I like the Joseph Cotton. I've gotten Seth Rogen like four times, and then
Seth Rogen. No, I didn't get Joseph Cotton. I was kidding, but
oh,
I would.
Okay. That'd be awesome.
That would be an awesome compliment, though,
and like a weird, like out of the where did that come from, sort of compliment.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing, Agnes Moorehead. I was going to go Agnes Moorehead with that joke, yeah. But I thought I should keep it to Joseph Cotton.
It'd be like saying, you know, you sound like a young Maurice Booth.
You sound like an old Orson Welles.
Yes.
Nobody ever says old.
No.
You sound like an old, like just before death, Vincent Price. it's just. Which reminds me, we're going off topic right already. I went to the doctor a few weeks ago. This is a true story, not a joke. And as the woman helped me at the front desk, young lady, when she was finished, and I wasn't being fresh. This was a true thing. I said, "Has anyone ever told you that you?" You kind of look like a young Sigourney Weaver. And she said, "Oh, I don't know who that is." And I said, right after the slap across my face, I went, "Oh, you know what? She was in Ghostbusters." And she went, "Oh, right. Oh, wait, the new one or the original?" I said, "The original." I went through Alien, Aliens, Working Girl. I went through her entire oeuvre. I went through One Woman or Two with Gérard Depardieu and Dr. Ruth. Nothing. She hadn't seen anything. She ended up looking her up on IMDb. And then I could tell she Googled the images, and the first image she got was, you know, Sigourney Weaver today. So that just made that compliment. The whole thing just went down the toilet.
And she went home and said, "Some jerk said I look like Sigourney Weaver."
Sigourney. So anyway, yes, I'm here on this end. Hi, everybody. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, we, of course, we're not as back as fast as we wanted to. We've both been having some fun on our ends, but it's looking better, especially in here. I have a door now, so that sound won't just echo out to the hallway. But
the only problem is they put it on the ceiling.
That's
but,
right.
He does have a door now. So
I'm not good at instructions.
Small, minor miracles.
Yeah. So, we have a very fun episode planned, one that I am It's safe to say this is my Beatles.
But I was just going to say, this is one that I can just sit back and let you, and I can just soak up the info, because I know how much you love this topic, and we've been talking about it for what seems like, I remember talking about this as a topic when I saw you in person.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, right?
You know, I was thinking about this today. There is nothing I haven't watched more in my life than SCTV.
Really? What about Gilmore Girls? You were a big
fan of Gilmore Girls. Well, you know, I kind of dropped out about the third season.
Oh, you did? Okay. All right.
Third season.
I would believe that, because frankly, you know, we both know a lot of useless stuff.
There's
But you constantly amaze me at just how much you know about this topic. So
this may be my favorite television show of all time.
Should we tell them after all this suspense? Do you want to go ahead and let it out?
I think I did let it out. But
oh, did you let it out of the bag?
Yeah, and anybody who's clicking on this will know the topic. So
oh, that's true.
Yeah, it's like,
oh man,
it's right on the label.
Can't it be like one of those you know, opening videos, just like toy opening videos, where you don't know what's in the bag?
An unboxing question mark.
Unboxing podcast.
Well, I tell you, it would save me a lot of time in designing all the stuff for it. Cause like, you know, just have a picture of a guy shrugging his shoulders. I don't know.
And then, you know, mystery topic again this week.
But the topic today is SCTV.
Woohoo!
And before I get to that, we should probably talk about what happened this week, and that is the fact that we lost Gene Wilder.
We lost Gene Wilder, and, you know, it's one of these things that, you know, I guess, you know, it's not a huge shock. It's not the shock that, you know, that David Bowie was just for...
Yeah, I mean, the man was 83.
The man was 83, and I think it had been rumored for a long time that he hadn't been well, and he's sort of been, you know, retired for quite a few years. But... you know, and I think it's just one of those things that hits people because only because of you know, only a handful of movies. This is not a guy that made a movie a year, you know, for 40 years. He was very selective in what he did, and I said this to somebody when you know, like the day after, I was talking to somebody about it, and it was you can pick apart the whole career, and this thing didn't work, and this didn't, and toward the end, it doesn't matter. To me, it's like Francis Ford Coppola. Like, you know, you'll never forgive him for making something like Jack, whatever. But anyone that would bitch, I'd turn around and go, yeah, but the output he had just in the 70s to do Godfather 1 and 2, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now, the other one that I'm forgetting, but I'm just saying, like, that short amount of The Conversation. Did I say The Conversation? I did.
You did.
Anyway, that four or five films in a particular tight frame. And Gene Wilder, you know, the producers was 68. Willy Wonka was 71, but people forget Willy Wonka was a flop when it came out, and he really didn't do much. For a couple of years. It took a couple of years to sort of get things going.
You say that, but, you know, we, like, you and I both didn't see that movie. We weren't alive to see that in the theater. We would have...
Oh, no, God, no, no. For me...
That movie, by the time you and I were able to see Shapes and Colors, was on TV every year, and it was, like, must-see TV.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just saying you know, it's one of those things to me, like a cult film that builds this audience, like It's a Wonderful Life. I don't think It's a Wonderful Life did well when it was originally released.
Or, and then even something like Leave It to Beaver was just a middling show.
Yeah, I mean,
but I could recite every episode.
There's loads of stuff you could go, yeah, well, that, you know, and so Willy Wonka, you know, gained in stature as the years went on, and it became this perennial, and then he became, you know, I think almost most associated. Most of the things I'm seeing and the tributes I'm seeing are about Willy Wonka. But for me, my first exposure to him, I think, was Young Frankenstein. I know that I saw Young Frankenstein on a re-release in the theater. I want to say the Grandview Theater in St. Paul. It was a re-release. Had to be 77 or 78 or something, And I was aware of Silver Streak. I don't know if Silver Streak had been on television at that point, because Silver Streak, I think, was 76 or so. But then going working backwards, you know, I then discovered Dr. Strangelove. I then discovered The Producers in, you know, this film he did with Brooks in 68. And that is my favorite thing in the world from Gene Wilder is I don't think that the lunacy of that particular part, my God, I mean, just I don't know where those thoughts must have come from to decide to go the way he did with Leo Bloom and the manic energy and everything. That was the high watermark for me. But then, you know, in a very short amount of time, you had that, you had Willy Wonka, you had Blazing Saddles, you had Young Frankenstein and Silver Streak. And so in a less than 10-year period, you know, every one of those is a classic. Well, Silver Streak, not as classic as a comedy, but classic stuff in there. That it didn't really matter what else he did after that, because, you know, three of those are considered, you know, some of the greatest comedies of all time. And so, yeah, that was my introduction to him. And so, well, I'll tell you what I loved about him. You tell me what you love about him, and then we'll kind of wrap this up. But just RIP, you know, Gene Wilder. But what about you? What was your first sort of exposure to his work?
I think it would have had to have been Charlie and Chocolate Factory, because I was very young, and it made me cry. I was.
Oh, yeah.
Violet Beauregard sent me into a whole catatonic state. However, I would say the film that I love the best is Stir Crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
is it Stir
Crazy? I think I was probably 11.
That closed out the 70s. That was 1980, right?
Yeah,
that was...
It's Sidney Poitier directed it. And yes, I don't know if it was the dawn of the VHS cassette or what happened, but I'd seen that. I think the old man liked prison movies. And it was a funny movie, and I just recently rewatched it. It came up on demand, and I hadn't seen it in years. And you know, Wilder's character is hilarious in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's very low key, but the first thing you notice is that, like, apparently he just gets laid all over town. And the right. other thing is he's just unbelievably zen about everything.
Yeah. Tries to fix everyone's
stuff.
Yeah,
and it's so wonderful. And, you know, a lot of people say it's almost like he's the straight man to Pryor, but they just play off each other so well that I never missed one of their films after.
You had Silver Streak in 76, then you had Stir Crazy in 80, you had what were there two more after that?
I even went to see Gene and Hanky Panky, which was a terrible movie. I saw it at a drive-in with my parents.
Was that with Gilda?
Yeah, it's just not...
Well, so he had that one, he had The Woman in Red, he had Haunted Honeymoon.
Haunted Honeymoon, which is another one with Gilda, I think.
And John Candy, I think, was in...
They did Hear No Evil, See No Evil.
Yes, I've seen it.
And then Another You, when Another You is a real disaster.
Oh, right.
But actually, did you know that I read somewhere, or I heard it on the radio this week, that Trading Places was originally written for Wilder and Pryor?
Oh, I didn't know that. I'd never heard that, I don't think.
Yeah, I think John Landis said that recently.
Well, if anyone's telling the truth, it's John Landis. The thing that I'll always think of with Wilder, and I didn't really understand this until I got older and really studied comedy and, you know, saw more things and did more things, you know. When I think about something like Fawlty Towers, which I consider to be, and some people consider to be, the single greatest sitcom ever written, even though there's only 12 episodes. And, you know, like, some of them are good, and then there's a chunk that are great, and then there's a chunk of four or five that are sublime, like a Swiss watch. But if you think about the character of Basil Fawlty, yes, he's 6'5", you know, he's a string bean, and you know, he's always looks kind of depressed, and he's irritated by the guests. But he doesn't start every episode being funny or doing funny things. It's the shit that happens around him that he reacts to, and his reactions are hysterical. And when you break it down that way, you're basically saying the comedy comes out of what naturally starts to happen. And when I think back about Wilder's stuff and I think about what he did in those parts, if you really start to go back and dig through it, he's not being goofy or being a character, you know, right out the gate. He is either neurotic or he's lonely or he's anxious. And I posted a clip from Young Frankenstein, and this is, to me, is the best example, where he nearly gets throttled by Peter Boyle's creature, and he sits down with Marty Feldman's Igor and says, "Can I just, you know," I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, would you sit down for a moment so we can talk? And he tries to ask him, the brain that I asked you to get, that wasn't the brain that you got, was it? No. Okay. Ah, good. And he just calmly gets through this, and you can just feel the anger seething up from his shoes. And as soon as you get to the Abby Normal bit, and he says, he almost kind of giggles like, "Abby Normal," you know, and then everything starts to kick off and he goes to strangle him. That's what he did best, and to me, better than anyone, was the natural thing happens, and his comedy could be, I mean, his comedic reaction could be completely subtle or explosive, but it was reactive. It was reacting to what happened just before. He wasn't being, you know, Mr. Goofy.
Yeah, he was able to go off the rails amazingly.
Yeah,
The other thing I think about him, and this kind of goes into our topic today in a way, is that he left. He just kind of retired.
Yeah.
And when they asked him, you know, I think he did a wonderful interview about 2 or 3 years ago with one of the fellows from AMC, and he said, "Well, yeah, I get scripts all the time, but I don't want to do 3D explosions. I don't." You know, he had a standard, and it wasn't so much that he retired; it's just he never got anything he wanted to do again. And that's an amazing allure when you don't wear out your welcome. And one of the people that I would say that's doing that right now is Rick Moranis.
Well, I've heard little rumors throughout that he's starting to sort of take phone calls.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's always taken like voiceover work and done that sort of thing, but he. You know, like they asked him about a Ghostbusters remake, and he said, "Oh, I have no interest in doing that," and you know, things like that. But
right.
he's one of these people that people are fascinated with because he's kind of holding out. He's kind of saying, "Yeah,
yeah." And that you're right. Wilder sort of, you know, and I think part of it too was unlike a lot of. You know, I'll be honest with you. We should get right into the topic. I'm sorry. But you know, I'll be honest with you. I would have loved if the Python team had made it their way to the U.S. for those reunion shows. They only did them in the U.K., and I would have paid anything to have been there to see them. But, and I'm actually, I've got two tickets, whoever wants to go with me. No. For Cleese and Eric Idle are doing a show here in November, you know, doing sketches and telling stories and shit. But I have to tell you, seeing the DVD of those shows from a couple years ago, my heart sank a little bit. Like the rhythm just isn't there. The manic sort of energy. It's not like being on stage or recording an album or something. And maybe it's best that Wilder kind of went away when he did, because we know him as this guy that could turn it on a dime.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like it's that bit in the anniversary, the Doctor Who anniversary special, 50th anniversary, where Tom Baker sort of shuffles out on a cane to be near Matt Smith. And there's just that little flicker. You know when he does the shh, and he puts his finger up to his lips when he does that little bit, and you go, "Oh my God, that's it. That's Tom Baker." But he's not the guy that was, you know, 42, you know, bouncing around the room and everything. And
yeah.
And sometimes it's maybe best to leave it there.
Well, I listened to a morning radio show, and one of the things they said once was one of the hosts said that Gene Wilder's face just appeared in the door. Like he was just like, "Oh, what's going on in here?" And the host, whose name's Jim Norton, like ran out into the hall because it was his hero, you know. And
right.
"Oh my God, Mr. Wilder, you have to come on the air with us. You know, we're but they were shock jocks. Kind of, and he went, "Oh, I can't keep up with you guys." And he just, he was very nice about it, but he was like, "Oh, no, 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 no."
But he also, but see, that's interesting because he always Nope, helicopter. Sorry. But this is a good time. He always said that he wasn't very funny. You know, he always said that he wasn't very naturally funny, you know. And I remember once Carson had Ron Howard or somebody on. I think it was Carson. And at that point, he had worked with both Tom Hanks and Michael Keaton. And Carson asked him, who's funnier? It was just a general sort of, hey, well, who's more funny? And he told Carson, he said, you know, it's completely different. I mean, Tom Hanks in a scene, Tom Hanks is naturally funny. And in a scene, he's very funny the way he plays it. But naturally, Michael Keaton is a force of nature. And it was just, you know, just the riffing and the improv and everything. And Wilder always struck me that he needed a sort of a script to be funny. But he found the humor in. He obviously knew he was doing. He didn't, you know, do a bunch of dramatic work. But there was drama in, you know, which is ironic here, because I did think of this when we were going to say let's do this 5 minutes here to talk about Wilder. He found the truth in these characters, brought out the comedy and the lunacy that, you know, sort of evolved from. I mean. You know, Dr. Frankenstein and Leo Bloom. He's not trying to be funny. He just knows that the blue blanket is away from him, and he's getting hysterical because he can't get it back. And this is what a grown man would do if he were this, you know, devolved or whatever. Well, that kind of falls into SCTV, because SCTV, those guys were so good at what they did. They made you slightly uncomfortable, but they also found the pathos. And the borderline sort of, you know, sadness in these characters.
And it's a cringe factor to SCTV.
It's a cringe factor. And you see it in Ricky Gervais's stuff, especially the Derek thing he did after Extras on Netflix.
Yeah.
You see it all over the place, even Baskets, which I love so much. But why don't we start with you being from Canada?
Yeah.
Telling the rest of the world here, or people, you know, that region that are listening as well, when you sort of first came across what we now know as SCTV.
You know what? This is very rare that I say this, but I was the first guy in the door. The show came out, I believe, in the mid to like 76 or 79.
Mm-hmm.
I can honestly remember turning on Global and seeing the first couple of episodes, and I remember that because their graphic was, you know, the test pattern Indian?
Yeah, he's laughing.
He's laughing. Like, and yes. I remember just being...
so weird.
It worked on my level. I was probably 6 years old at best. Okay. I can honestly remember telling my mom, oh my God, the show is so funny, and, you know, blah, 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 and my mom just rolling her eyes, which she did for the entirety of the show's airing, and it went away. I remember this too. It came on and went off. Came on and went off. It was
okay.
You know, very low rent, but I definitely glommed onto it at a very, very early age. And when it was on, I sought it out and I would watch it. And I my whole childhood is SCTV.
So if you sort of see it. Hazy memories, you know, 76, 77.
I'd say 77. I think it came out in 77. Yeah.
So we're talking Dave Thomas, Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, John Candy, Joe Flaherty, Harold Ramis.
And Harold Ramis for the first two seasons, I think.
So Ramis was in the first two seasons.
Yes. He was the only one that hadn't. There was a show before then that I don't remember called The David Steinberg Show.
Oh yeah,
and they. But it's,
no. I just say that. I don't mean like, hey, I was watching it when I was four. No, I just remember this this comedy special about Steinberg, and it went. Now that you just say that again, I forgot to look into this. Martin Short was on that show.
Yeah, and they. I don't think it was like 76 or 77. They replayed them later on when they got a Canadian comedy network in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So I have seen them all. And yeah, it's really weird to see all this SCTV folks on it. And one of the additions was, and this is kind of funny because my friend had a crush on her back in the day, was a woman by the name of Trudy Young was also in the Steinberg show. And years later, my friend was a janitor at a mall. And okay. He was talking about Trudy Young, and he goes, "Oh yeah, she works over at that luggage store. You want to say hi?"
No.
Yeah. Wow. She was also in the Frog Prince, the you know, the Muppet movie. The Frog, I think it's just called The Frog Prince.
Wait, the Shelley Duvall fairy tale theater thing?
Was that one? No.
Yeah, Shelley Duvall did like a bunch of.
She did The Frog Prince. What's the one she's in? She's in the 1971 version of The Frog Prince, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I'm thinking of something else then.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But it was just kind of funny because my friend had a crush on her and he ends up working with her at a mall. That's Canadian celebrity for you.
Nice.
Yeah, they did that, and then they went on to the SCTV. Obviously, the show, and I've read books on this and such, the show is very low budget for the global years. And I believe the fellow who was putting it all together was a guy by the name of Andrew Alexander, who was involved with Second City in Canada. And, things were meager. However, all those people, Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, Harold Thomas, Harold Ramis, Dave Thomas, I had seen them on Canadian television before. John Candy shows up in movies in the 70s in Canada. He's also, there's a show called Cucumber, which Children's Underground Club of United Moose and Beaver, four enthusiastic reporters. It's a Rocky and Bullwinkle ripoff.
What you said was so fast, I thought you said United Mussolini supporters.
No, Moose, yes, I did, actually. It was an odd show.
the kids were into Mussolini.
No, it was a Rocky and Bullwinkle ripoff with a beaver and a moose. But John Candy appeared in an episode called, and he was Weatherman. So if you can picture a young John Candy in a skin-tight spandex outfit. I can't seem to find it on YouTube. Maybe I will for the show. And Catherine O'Hara was in Anison commercials, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
Dave Thomas did a bunch of beer commercials and things. And Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin were in a movie called Cannibal Girls for Ivan Reitman, who went on to do nothing.
Oh, my God. Was that something that like got sort of a VHS, you know, home video release?
Oh, yeah.
In the 80s? Oh my God! I remember. You know what I think of too. We're already jumping way ahead of ourselves here. I remember just like the SNL, SC, all the cross pollination with some of that stuff. You know, like something like Stripes with Ramis in it, and then Flaherty ends up being one of the guards at the border, and you know, things like that. There was just this slew of stuff that hit home video in the mid '80s that you thought was like a new release. Like, oh look, it's a new. You know, it's a new movie with what was that sneaker one? It was called like something sneaker, Cruel Shoes or not Cruel Shoes? What the hell?
Loose Shoes. This is the second time I've discussed Loose Shoes today. Weird.
You're joking.
No. Okay. I talked about it today. Things,
and then you'd look at the box and you'd go, oh, when did this hit? I don't remember this hit in the theaters. What the? And instead, it's a compilation of weird Canadian stuff or something.
No, Loose Shoes was actually
sketches that get.
Yeah, Loose Shoes was like a sketch movie, like Kentucky Fried Movie or anything.
Right?
Like, yeah.
But it was before SNL or right after or something?
I think it was during. I think it was like 78.
But wasn't like Murray and Candy and guys like that in it?
No, Murray was in it. I don't remember Candy being in that one. At least I think of Loose Shoes, yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking of something else. But there were all these little things that sort of were early 70s or mid 70s things that started to get like these weird.
Like the Groove Tube.
The Groove Tube
had Chevy Chase in it.
Yes,
and that was way before Saturday Night Live.
That's what I'm thinking of, and that got like a video release, and you're like, "Oh, check it out!"
Well, I was just joking about somebody. Like the Loose Shoes has about 3 minutes of Bill Murray in it, and it's a funny scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a longer movie than that,
right?
And when I picked up
the rest is all Mark Blankenfeld.
No, it isn't. Thank God. It was the rest of it is hit or miss comedy, but when I picked up a DVD of it at like a hardware store in the early 90s
as you do, you're going in for some lug nuts and you know like, hey, look, there's a copy of Loose.
It's happened. The cover is often like what you see in shitty movies that have one name star in it. It was a huge picture of Bill Murray.
Exactly.
It says Loose Shoes. And
remember the Robin Williams, Can I Do It Till I Need Glass?
Oh, yeah, Robin Williams on the front. Or the one I love is actually, he's in the whole movie, but it's Burt Reynolds and Shark. But it's I think Shark is a 60s movie. And
God, I don't even heard of that.
It's always like a Smokey and the Bandit picture of Burt Reynolds on the front.
I love that shit because I used to work at a video store.
Oh yeah,
I used to love the, you know, the covers of just the, you know, the person was in it for one scene or barely in it, or, you know, it's like Eddie Murphy in Best Defense. You know, he's got two scenes and he tried to get out of the movie.
Yeah, on the 13th release of it, it's just a picture from like Delirious.
Eddie from Delirious popping up out of a tank.
Yeah. I always love it when it's like a modern picture of them, but the film is 30 years old.
Right. He's bald. Yeah. No, but okay. So, all right. So let me just back up here and then I'm going to let you take it. My recollection is it's got to be, you know, I had to have been right there, right around 81 when this thing first started to hit NBC, 81 or 82.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, a couple of which are kind of personal, involving my parents' separation at the time when I was just a kid, and what that sort of meant to me and my dad to be with him on, you know, certain nights of the month kind of thing and stay up late and get to watch SNL. I mean, sorry, SCTV. But, you know, SNL had been on, you know, since the mid-70s. But like I told you before, I don't remember much of a time before, you know, Monty Python being in my life. So, you know, I've got a couple of audio cassette tapes that we recorded Monty Python off the television, and I'm like 6 or 7. You can hear me laughing on these things. But I knew the difference between, you know, Python and SNL. And it's not that I didn't like SNL or I wasn't into it as a kid. Everybody was. Everybody talked about it. But I gravitated toward Python. And as I got older as a young kid, got snobby about it, that they're much funnier than Saturday Night Live. And I still don't think SNL could hold, you know, at its best, could hold a candle to Python.
Well, I feel that same way about SCTV.
But I was going to say, but even more, if Python is my high watermark, SCTV is about a quarter of an inch behind Python with what they did.
Oh, it's amazing.
And they're miles in front of SNL. So when this thing would come on like on a Friday night, and I was just like, what the hell? And I just – Candy, I might have seen in something before that. I don't know. But he was the most instantly familiar person, and
he was the dropout star of the show. Too.
It was a love affair, and I was, you know, I was obviously aware enough of the show when, you know, Bob and Doug took off in the U.S. and became this frickin' sensation with the album and everything else that, you know, in Strange Brew, which, by the way, just ordered on DVD Blu-ray for like $7 or $8. I know there's a new edition of it out. Yeah. But anyway, so that's my thing. So you tell me what this meant to you as a kid, and you know, being a hometown choice of humor.
Well, the number one thing about it, and this is something that, and I don't mean to sound snobby, but if you didn't grow up in Canada or at least like Southern Ontario, you didn't catch that they were making fun of our television. And some of the points are, you know. Joe Flaherty's character of Lloyd Robertson is making fun, and this is not the most clever name, but Floyd Robertson, who's a news anchor. To this day, I think Floyd Robertson's a news anchor. I'm just going to go through a few of the things. I know I mentioned Crazy Highs last time, which is a making fun of Crazy Joe's, which was these batshit crazy cheap commercials that used to run. This is one I don't even know until I read about it, which was Schmengies. The Schmengies came when the guys were in the third season. They were filming in Edmonton, and they were all living in a hotel together. And there was a show on in, like, Leduc, Edmonton, called Polka Time, where a guy would put a polka record on and then put the album on an easel and then stand to the side. And I guess like John Candy and Eugene Levy were like, that guy's a Schmengie, and that's where it came from.
But see, here's what here's what I'm just gonna, you know, here's my this is the dissertation I'll be giving at the Learning Annex next Tuesday night, if you can make it.
I've got to teach a class on how to eat an orange.
But no, here's the thing about what you just said. There was a great article written many, many years ago. I think it was like the Wall Street Journal or something, when the Python scripts got put into books and released in paperback in like 89 or whatever it was. And this guy that was, you know, in love with everything that they did, and he was going on about how fresh these scripts are. And it reminded me of being a kid too. And there's one sketch in particular where this guy, Mr. Norris, whatever his name, has always had a theory that the inhabitants of Surbiton were descended from the inhabitants of Hounslow. And then the sketch goes on about, you know, the way their slang is, the way they each use the same lawnmower, and the way the husbands, you know, whatever. I didn't need to know where Hounslow and Surbiton were.
I get you.
I got the
humor was universal.
Exactly. And the thing about SCTV is I didn't find out a lot of this stuff until many years later, which made me appreciate it more. But for those of us that didn't get the in joke, all we thought was they're called the Schmengis because they kind of talk like this.
Well, and that's the beauty of the whole
But that's
thing.
The beauty of it. And so the thing is, like what they were doing, and people forget that was they were spoofing a network, and everything on this pretty much were spoofing the mediums of, you know, soap operas or talk shows or whatever it was. And so you kind of jumped into this real world, but for very, you know, like they were doing the spoof of Play It Again, Sam, with Bob Hope and Woody Allen. If you think that was like 82 or whatever it was,
it was super early to be doing that.
It was super early to be doing so much stuff.
Let me just go to this because it kind of gives me a little grounding as to what I'm talking about. You know, in the 70s, the Canadian identity didn't exist. You guys were just so overpowering with their pop culture.
I know.
And, I already at an early age knew what was American and what was Canadian. And I, you know, because we were also told Canadian programming was crap by our parents.
You had Seeing Things.
We had Seeing Things, and that was our rock. But I can remember once, and I think it's a really obscure sketch. It's not that it's. We used to have these commercials on in Toronto called Gibner Carpet. And it was this guy who looked like he just did a line of coke, you know, with his leisure suit on. And he would be talking about shag carpeting. And, you know, he moved around a lot. And I can honestly remember being a little kid and watching Eugene Levy doing Gary's Nails. Right. It was a Gibner Carpet knock. It, you know, he was dressed like the Gibner guy. And he's like, look at these nails. And, you know, he was acting all crazy. And I was like, holy crap, he's doing a Gibner Carpet. Like, you know, what does he live around the corner from me? And, and I think he did, actually. And this is a, I told you this a couple of months ago. My real estate agent is an older guy. He's an old friend of the family. And he's, you know, I talked about SCTV or something. And he goes, oh, I used to live next door to the Flaherty Brothers.
No, you said that.
In the 80s, like the early 80s. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. And it was just like, yeah, he partied with all of them.
God, can you imagine?
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to hang out with these guys. Like,
yeah, and that's the other thing is that people don't even realize, like, Joe Flaherty's brother was behind the scenes.
That's right. Paul.
Martin Short's brother was behind the scenes writing.
Was it Paul Flaherty? Is that his brother?
I can't remember now.
But look at let's just go back.
Mike Short is Martin Short's brother.
Well, let's go back to the pedigree here again, though. I mean, not only the cast and the caliber of what came off of this show. You know, if you want to talk about SNL, like you can count of the thousands of people that have been in the cast of SNL, you can count on one hand the number that you of people you point to and you go, wow, you know, 40 years of genius or whatever. Python, the same thing. They went off and did different things, but they stayed pretty consistent in the caliber of stuff that they did, you know, for the most part. But with SCTV, it's like, I mean, everybody on there. I mean, maybe Robin Duke, maybe Tony Rosato. Like, no, I'm not trying to be mean to anybody, but I'm saying Candy, Flaherty. You know, who Flaherty kind of disappeared, but I mean, he showed up and said he'd be the least visible. But Andre Martin, Catherine O'Hara, Moranis, ironically, probably what became the Right? The biggest thing that ever came off the show.
And you know what drives everybody crazy about that is he was never Second City. He was a DJ.
Oh, yeah.
He was a DJ on Chum FM, and he was just, I think, friends with Dave Thomas.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That was in the book. I had the SCTV book in there.
Yeah, he was – he never did any improv ever.
But they, what I was trying to get at was, you know, Looney Tunes. You know, one of the things that Chuck Jones always used to say was very little of their stuff. If you go back and look at those cartoons, very little was topical.
Yeah.
Very little was a topical reference. SNL would be dated a week later. And you could say the same thing about Monty Python. Like, very little of that, you know, they might reference Margaret Thatcher or, you know, Harold Wilson or someone like that. But it was – they were about archetypes. And so if you if they were spoofing, you know, the crazy TV guy or the Schmengis or, you know, whatever, especially being in the Twin Cities, I felt like this was something very close.
Well, they made their own universe too.
They made their own universe.
They made their own characters.
I thought they were making fun of the guy that was local, the local TV guy that would – you know, it was – you know, sort of, you know, not topical and also just kind of, you know, they were archetypes. It didn't matter whether we had the reference for it or not. Because you told me, I mean, I knew this way back, but you got much more detailed into how Bob and Doug McKenzie even sort of came to life.
Yeah, it was a bit of a joke. They needed, I think they were on CBC at the time, and they needed there was jokes about CanCon, which is Canadian content, to make, and that we still suffer with that. Our Netflix sucks compared to yours, where, you know, everything has to be Canadian content. And so they created this bit, and they improvised the whole thing. I mean, there's nothing. The Doug and McKenzie are not written bits, and then the credits would be a joke about how it was all about Canadian content and learn more about being Canadian, but they just chose they chose to create these archetypes, which, you know, there's always truth in these kind of things.
But wasn't there sort of a brief too that was like, you guys, there's got to be, you know, you've got to have more, or the show itself wasn't having enough. When you say content, what is that referring to? Like, it had to be local, sort of, you know,
Canadian content.
What does that mean exactly for the rest?
I will read you the definition. Canadian content, CanCon, or Can-Con, refers to the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission (CRTC) requirements derived from the broadcast. I don't know. I guess you got to mention Yonge Street once in a while.
Okay.
It's just one of these things where, you know, every third song on a radio has to be Rockin' Hyde as opposed to Rolling Stones. Or, you know, like in the 80s, you would get all these weird Canadian hit pop songs, and you'd be like, isn't that the guy who sings the McCain Superfries theme song?
Right.
And it would be because, you know, he'd... Was it one joke I heard was, well, if you go to the Canadian Music Awards, you see taxis as opposed to limos. it's just funny. One of those things where they were basically, because when it moved to SCT or CBC television in 1980, it became that's a government institution. It is our version of the BBC.
Okay.
We're very sensitive about creating things that are about Canada to a fault. I'm sorry. And so they basically just kind of thought, well, what's the most Canadian thing we can do? So they, you know, they put on toques. They talked with that A. They created the name Hoser. We never – that didn't exist.
Right.
And they basically just, you know, drank beer, cooked back bacon, which is our – you know, which is called Canadian Baker, and they smoked, I think, at the time. And they just played basically two Scarborough dorks at the time. Like,
and what, tell us all what a toque is? I mean, what is that referring to?
It's a hat. It's a winter hat.
But why is it called a toque?
Oh. Eh? I don't know. And you know, you're from a further north place than me, so you can't do
that. No, I know. That's what I was saying was there was a time there in the early 80s too where I started to think there must have been like sort of a Minnesota connection with this show because the accents are very similar. The climate when they would do outdoor stuff was very similar.
Oh yeah,
and you know, I Bob and Doug are, you know, extreme accents and extreme sort of character.
But then
you see something like Fargo, and I have to tell you, I saw Fargo when it came out in 96, 97, whatever it was, out in a theater in LA, and it was, you know, only half full, but I was laughing my ass off through the whole movie where no one was laughing because I thought, oh my God, you know, they're really going to an extreme with the accents here, but that is Minnesota.
Do you remember the movie This Ain't Hollywood, the Australian cinema?
Is it called This Ain't Hollywood or Almost Hollywood? Was it This Ain't Hollywood?
I thought it was This Ain't Hollywood.
I think you're right. That is one of the best documentaries.
It's amazing. And there's a guy in there, and I can't remember his name, but he did four or five movies where he played basically the stereotypical Australian.
Yes! And they were
a-hole. Like he would go and barf on the Queen.
And he was nude during most of it.
Yeah, and he was always drinking a can of Foster's and acting like an ass. And it turns out he was a really educated guy, and he was doing what would be called a piss take.
Right.
For Australians. And he said the most depressing thing in the world for him was to go to one of the premieres and just have people show up half drunk, throwing up, going yeah, like to the character that he's like, oh no, you've missed the satire. And you know, I think that was a bit of the Bob and Doug thing,
right?
And that is really the legacy of SCTV, sadly, is I don't know about you, but like it was humongous when I was in the sixth grade. It was everywhere, and being an SCTV fan to begin with, I just rode that wave because my parents never liked the show. And I can remember one day my dad was a night owl, and I woke up on a Saturday morning, and he goes, have you ever seen the Newfies on SCTV? And I was like, no, what are you talking about? He goes, oh, they got these two Newfie brothers, and they're hilarious. Now, Newfie stands for Newfoundlanders.
Newfie, that's right.
And I have no idea why my dad thought they were Newfoundlanders. I guess because you never want to think it's about you, right?
Well,
like it's not a parody of you.
A lot of people that I would talk to about Fargo after it came out, and I would call home and go, "Hey, did you see the new Coen Brothers?" People didn't like it.
Yeah,
they were very irritated by what they were doing in there. You know, sort of poking fun at the mid, you know, like old country buffet, and you know, meeting at the Radisson for drinks and everything. You know, that's kind of how people talk in the Twin Cities. You know,
I think it's a really high. Like, I think what I read, a lot of the comments back in the day were like, only the old people talk like that. And
oh, no. Oh, that's not true at all. No. Oh, no, no. It's like when you go to the grocery store and, like, you're checking out or Target if you want help with something. And, like, oh, did you get something for the weekend or just for, like, any time of year?
Well, you know what? I used to work with a guy by the name of Rob. And every time, this is going back about 15 years, but he'd go, oh, I left those back in the house.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I would cringe.
Yeah.
And I'd be you're doing that thing.
My grandmother on the Irish-German side, my mother's mother, I remember the word about. She'd always say about.
Yeah, yeah. This guy would always say, oh, that's about 20 bucks. And I'd be like,
oh, about.
Stop
doing that.
We don't talk like that.
And I hear, when I go back, and, you know, there are some very thick.
Oh, yeah.
Thick accents, but it's very much like it's not as thick as Fargo, but it's oh yeah, okay, oh, and then where are you going for Thanksgiving?
How crazy SCTV got with Canadiana, because Bob and Doug McKenzie are just the tip. In fact, they're not even the most Canadian thing. They did a parody of a 70s film once, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's about hockey, and John Candy plays Billy, and I think he's supposed to be Daryl Sittler. It's supposed to be a Canadian film from the 70s. It's already the early 80s, so this is brilliant. Shatner, which is Dave Thomas, is the hockey coach.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it's got these long, pandering scenes with, you know, Rick Moranis going, Billy, my Billy boy. Like, it is not only... It's people in the States. This played on NBC. I have no grounding into what this is, and what it is it's a parody of a Canadian movie. It says, you know, William Shatner, Daryl Sittler, and which John Candy playing Daryl Sittler was always hilarious.
But see, I don't. But
and,
see,
and,
this
and,
is
and it would say, it would say Donald Sutherland, and it would be about hockey, and it'd be this weird ass, terrible, you know, 70s movie about hockey, and you'd be like, what the hell did Americans think of this? Because
Here's my flip side, and I keep going back to Python because I find a lot of similarities.
Just find the universality of it, like you.
Well, okay, so here we go back to this. A, the Pythons always said the one thing they agreed on, the only thing that all six of them could ever agree on was whatever they were doing, it would never work in the U.S.
Oh, I see.
The U.S. would never get this humor. It would never work. It was too insular. It wouldn't happen. When I was seven. And I see the sketch, you know, like Eric Idle's hosting a show going, next week we're going to be looking at Sam Peckinpah's new film, Buckets of Blood Pouring Out to People's Heads. But tonight, you know, and I had no idea who Sam Peckinpah was. That joke is funny to me as a seven-year-old. And then it cuts to a bunch of people in the, you know, looking like they're on the set of The Great Gatsby in the early 20s. I say, anyone for tennis? And then someone throws a ball at Michael Palin, hits him in the head. Blood starts shooting out of his forehead, and the whole thing looks like a friggin' tea party, and everyone's being hacked to death, and blood's going everywhere. Now, that was in 71 or 72, whatever it was. It was their piss take on Sam Peckinpah only a year or two, you know, like it must have been right in between Wild Bunch and The Getaway, where they were already, you know, riffing on it. I had no frame of reference for what they were doing. I just knew that it was funny.
Yeah,
and it was complete lunacy. And SCTV, this stuff, half of this stuff that you're telling me, I had no idea.
Here's another one was
that specific. Now the Floyd thing. Oh, and then I got to tell, because I told you that I met Catherine O'Hara and Eugene Levy at this thing at the Paley Center, yes, right? This show.
And I told you I hated you.
Yeah, I know. But if it makes you feel any better, I was so nervous meeting Catherine O'Hara. I checked my hair. I came out of the bathroom, checking myself. I'm good. Well, she said, well, they're going to come out in a minute. Okay, well, I'll just be, oh, you know, do you want to meet her? Oh, no, it's okay. Don't be so, you know, I'm nervous. I can feel it. I've already had like two complimentary glasses of wine. And I took, this guy's coming around with a tray of stuff, and I had a little nibble, and I had this little nibble. There she is. I finally say hi to her, meet her. And just as I'm shaking her hand, my eyes kind of go down to my chest,
yeah,
and I've got a dollop of like cream cheese on my blazer.
Dude, you could have started lactating. I'm still mad at you.
Oh my God, I felt like such a dick that I finally met Catherine O'Hara, and this is how I look. And I bet she hasn't forgotten it, frankly.
No, she's
okay. But what was I just? What was to say something about
Floyd?
About,
you said something.
Floyd. Okay, so I actually talked to Eugene Levy about, you know, Floyd. Floyd Robertson and Earl Camembert, right?
Earl Camembert was...
Earl Camembert, and that Floyd was a riff on the newscaster, or the guy that did the Count Floyd thing. He did both in real life.
Yeah, he was... Yeah, Floyd... SCTV was such a cheap station that, yeah, Floyd also had to moonlight as Count Floyd.
Right.
And he's wearing an undershirt.
He's wearing like a turtleneck. Yeah,
like and a he's, turtle. Got, he's got... He's just got shinola on his forehead.
But
for
the
his
guy...
Nose
but,
peak.
But that he was based on someone, right?
He was based on Floyd Robertson. That I know.
Wait, wasn't that his name in the show?
Floyd Robertson.
Oh, Lloyd Robertson.
Yeah, who was a very dignified news guy.
He was a dignified news guy. Now, he didn't do, or did he? He didn't do a Count Floyd there, Count
no,
Lloyd.
No, but I think what they're doing. No, I don't know who did that. If they based on it, like
okay, so
he's
so,
from Chicago, so he could have been basing that on something.
That was the confusion when I said to him. I said, "Yeah, a friend of I mentioned you to Eugene Levy." And I said, "My friend, what's his name in Toronto, always tells me about the truths to these things and how they got started." And I started to tell that story. And I think he thought I meant that Lloyd Robertson did a Count Floyd thing as well.
Oh, no, yeah.
But even then, he kind of said, I don't know about it, that if – I don't think that was based on anybody.
Yeah,
and
I
think he, at that point, was thinking that Floyd wasn't even based on Lloyd.
No, it just
and
namesake.
Then I Oh, was it? Okay, yeah. then maybe that's what I was like. And I kind of, so I threw my drink in his face and I said, well, you're wrong, Mr. Levy.
Well,
my
apparently
friend,
Eugene Levy
Brian.
Has mentioned that Earl Camembert is partially based on Irv Weinstein, who was the Buffalo news guy that, you know, was an institution here. Right. You know, he was the guy, you know, he'd say, you know, downtown Buffalo in flames, news at 11, you know, or he was the do you know where your children
You know what?
Are.
It's funny you say this. It's funny you say this because I either recently saw something on YouTube or I remember this episode or something. It's a sketch where somebody like Michael McDonald comes in to do like just some background vocals.
Oh yeah, he's like driving forever just so he can go just a long way to go. Yeah.
Just a long way to go. Now, but isn't there I forget who that was, but isn't there a bit Rick Moranis does a character that I swear is Joel Silver, the movie producer.
Oh, I know exactly. You know what? That guy, I remember that character.
Is that who he's supposed to be doing?
I don't know if it's supposed to be Joel Silver, but...
Because by God, if it is, you almost go, oh my God, he had a time machine. And because I didn't think Joel Silver would have been that well known in the early 80s that he was this loud, you know, screaming sort of, because you got to figure, you know, Lethal Weapon was 87 or whatever, and Joel Silver, you know, plays the Raul, the director on screen in Roger Rabbit. So maybe he was kind of known even by 82, 83 that Moranis would have been spoofing him, but I couldn't believe it.
There was an SCTV book, and I've honestly read who that character is. I cannot remember the name of the character.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you this. My mother could not stand if that character was on TV because it reminded her of some friend of my dad's. And, yeah, I don't think I ever met that friend of my dad's. But, yeah, I totally know who you're talking about. And, yeah,
right?
It really it does. It is that hyperactive film producer. And, yeah, Rick Moranis nailed that character.
I thought that's...
So I wanted to give up another example of how meta and sad and Canadian it got. They did a parody of a Canadian film called Going Down the Road, and I don't expect you to have seen it, but
okay.
It's kind of a depressing movie about two guys who come down from Nova Scotia looking for jobs, and they think that the streets are paved with gold in Toronto, and they end up in all these kind of foibles, and it's kind of a depressing movie, actually. My father-in-law, I remember seeing it in the theater when it came out, and he said everybody just came out with their heads down, you know, Canadian cinema. SCTV does this brilliant parody of it called Gordon, Ted, Fiona, and Alice. And this is the thing that always makes me laugh is...
Oh, my God. Is it riffing on Bob and Carol, Ted?
Yeah, the name is. But it's, you know, in the SCTV version, John Candy and Joe Flaherty are a doctor and a lawyer from the Maritimes who are coming down to get jobs and stuff in Canada, right? And they come down to Toronto, of course. They're a doctor and a lawyer. They can't find a job. They just ended up hanging up in Yonge Street. And then, you know, Joe Flaherty knocks up Alice. Alice is played by the same woman who played the same character, Jane Eastwood, in Going Down the Road.
Oh, wow.
She's an old SCTV, or Second City actress as well. So
that's
just funny. Only in Canada would the same actress play the same part in the film.
Well, you know what? There was another, I swear, I could be getting this wrong, but I thought they did a Godfather spoof.
They did. It's awesome.
With Caballero and
what's his
name? Woltz is in the movie. The guy that was, you know, Woltz, the guy that wouldn't give Johnny Fontaine the part in the picture. That guy that played Woltz is in the Godfather spoof. He shows up in the SCTV spoof. And I don't know if he was Canadian actor or what it was, but he's in there. And
that's a really long parody of The Godfather.
It's really long. And some of their stuff kind of went a little long, but it's still, I'd watch it any day.
Well, do you know that like most
versus,
I saw the SCTV Ben-Hur before I saw the real Ben-Hur.
So did I.
I saw the SCTV Godfather before I saw the real Godfather.
But see, again, that's the lunacy. Like, what on God's green earth made John Candy decide to do Curly Joe?
It's still funny.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like it doesn't make any sense. But as a kid, all I knew was that John Candy was big and funny, and now he did a silly voice, and he's putting it on
instead of lepers,
a sword and sandals epic.
Instead of lepers, they're leopards.
God. Because my grandmother, Lindsay, you know, to the Italians,
Your Nona?
Easter and, you know, those kinds of movies are a big deal.
Yeah.
And so whenever holiday it was, Easter, whatever, when they would run that on Sunday, she, when the leper thing happened and Jesus, you only see Jesus, I think, from like, you don't see Jesus, but you see him walk through or something. She would cry. My Italian grandmother would cry on the sofa watching this Heston movie. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw the SCTV thing, I just poked a pin in the whole thing. It just made me hysterical.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't there a whole period too where they were doing, where like bands would show up? Like I remember the Tubes being on there.
Yeah,
and
the NBC years, they put a musical act and they would never do it straight. They'd never, you know, like the Boomtown Rats are in an amazing parody of To Sir With Love, but instead of it being it would be Ricardo Montalban as the teacher. I think the Tubes are in A Fish and Musician, which is another parody of a Canadian show, Red Fisher.
Wasn't there like, was it
the Plasmatics were on that too.
Plasmatics, was it George Thorogood or something, or
Dr. John was in
Dr. John.
He was in Polynesian Town, which was
right.
Johnny LaRue's big production. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would get really. Remember they did a beautiful Towering Inferno rip too? Do you remember that one?
Oh my God. Wait a minute. Do you know what I remember? I'm going to tell you two sketches that I remember, and you're going to know exactly what I'm talking
I
about.
Will.
They're just having sense memory recall here. There's the one where
oh my God.
It's Joe Flaherty is the father. Catherine O'Hara is like the strung out teenage daughter, and she like puts her face through a piece of bread.
That's the first episode. That's We're Leaving at Home All Right. And something like that.
The gay character, the gay son that Eugene Levy does, is so it's kind of over the top, but not like huge.
Skate, Johnny.
It is hilarious. And the other one was.
You want to know what's funny?
I remember
about that one especially. Is they're all eating out of the same soup bowls that my family had. They're just like Wolko soup bowls, I guess.
There's another one that I don't recall much about. I just remember, just like every now and then, there was a Python sketch that kind of sort of scared me a little bit as a kid. I don't know. It's hard to explain. Like, watching Holy Grail as an 8-year-old, it was very difficult until I saw it like the third time to get through the scene with the Black Knight and limbs getting hacked off and stuff. And every now and then, there was something in SCTV that just kind of made me a little uncomfortable. And as a kid, this scared the crap out of me. Do you remember the thing where the kid begs to be read a story at night, a bedtime story?
Oh, and Joe Flaherty scares him. Kills him.
And
right?
Joe Flaherty reads the story. And the camera pushes into Flaherty telling this story that's just grisly. And when the camera comes back out, the kid is white.
Yeah.
And his hair is white and it's standing straight up. And
is that
I thought
the one about the pimples? I seem to remember that's the one the girl doesn't wash her face and she's like all pimples by the end.
I just remember the kid like begs for this bedtime story.
Yeah.
And it's really grisly. And that I thought it was funny, but it kind of scared me. The shot of the kid, I thought the kid was dead or something.
The beautiful one of the last skit you just mentioned, which is called "We're Gonna Be All Right, You Creep, Leaving Home and All," eh? It's hosted by Lingyi Tang. It's the first episode, and Dave Thomas's Lingyi Tang was never a very politically correct idea.
Was he the one that hosted the talk show when Godzilla showed up and destroyed the set?
No, that was Tim Uchimuni.
That's God Almighty.
God, Dave Thomas had a real.
I'm sorry. I know how wrong it is. I know how wrong that is. But it was so over the top.
Yeah, it was so ridiculously
World War II
bad.
Yes, it was beyond Mickey Rooney. It was not.
Well, and you know, but the beautiful thing was Lingyi Tang comes out and he says, "I have the big book of Canadian plays, and it's this little tiny book." but yeah, everything on SCTV, the Jewel Hallmeyer dancers, everything was crap. You know, like the Jewel Hallmeyer dancers were just, you know, five dudes they could find and they would pretend to do a dance number and they were particularly supposed to be terrible. Jewel Hallmeyer was the show's costumer. He wasn't the dancer. And it's that kind of train wreck wonderfulness about the show that just kind of keeps going. And it also, it also puts that question in your mind, is this intentionally bad or is this just bad?
Well, they also, but the thing that set them up, well, that's the thing, like the Sammy Maudlin stuff, you know, all those
even the days of the week is too close to a real soap opera.
It's too close to real. But the characters of like Bittman, whenever they would take a moment on that talk about, and they would get real, you know, and they'd go like, look, I just got to say something right now. Let me tell you something.
In all seriousness.
You know, or when Bittman would like look at the camera and go, this crap that's being said about, you know, he sounded more Chicago. Like that character was more Chicago than it was, you know, Canadian to me. But like when they started to get real, there was like pathos to what they were doing with these characters. But the other thing that's really interesting about them, and I've always said this for years, when you think about comedy that was going on at the time, and you think about, forget how much they committed to the impression, or forget how much they committed to the riff on who they were impersonating, whatever. Forget that. The makeup, the hair, whatever. Because when Aykroyd did Jimmy Carter, he had a mustache, and I don't think he even colored his hair. No. When Chevy Chase did Gerald Ford, it was Chevy Chase falling against the podium. Nobody cared to get that. You know, Rich Little just did a bunch of voices. But when you go back to SCTV, they chose the strangest people to impersonate or riff off of. You know, Joe Flaherty doing a Kirk Douglas impression.
Yeah.
You know, like on whatever the game show was, and he just the whole time he's giving the answers. I mean, they did some really strange. And then for Thomas to do Bob Hope, and you know, that's the thing. When I met him, I told the story last time about meeting him at Comic-Con. And maybe I hope I'm not repeating the same story that I told last time, but I asked him, you know, did you ever meet, like when you met Bob Hope, or did you meet, he said, Bob Hope didn't think it was very, he thought we were kind of making fun. He thought I was kind of, you know, even though I tried to tell him that that's, I said, because I never thought you were making fun. I thought what you guys were doing was you were embracing it and you were paying homage to these people sort of. And if you really wanted to make fun, you'd kind of, you know, create a different sort of, you know, sort of character. But like the Moranis, the Woody Allen thing is like dead on.
Yeah.
And especially as a parody, but like they chose really strange. God, what was the one? Wasn't there a thing with like, like Candy would do Orson Welles, but
yeah, they were not ashamed to also just go for the cheap laugh.
They went for the cheap laugh, but he didn't try to sound like Orson Welles, really. It was more in the way he delivered the line. And they were riffing on those bloopers, those audio, like, you know, show me someone who can start a sentence with and I'll go down on him. You know, like that stuff that Welles did.
They did a thing once where it was Gene Shalit going to a restaurant that only had three booths, and it was William Conrad, Shelley Winters, and Orson Welles as the only, you know... it was really like no wonder I liked this as a kid, because, you know, it was just going right to the
winners, Orson Welles and Robert Conrad.
Yeah. William Conrad.
Okay.
They only had, you know, and they were, you know, there was a thing where, you know, Orson Welles, they bring John Candy a wheelbarrow full of lettuce and say, "Your salad." And he goes, "Good." And he goes, what dressing would you like? He's like, blue cheese and lots of it, you know. And they bring this bucket, and that was the beauty of the show, is they also just went for that complete lowbrow, you know, let's just amuse a 7-year-old me.
Did Martin Short? Because I started to fall in love with Martin. Like I
Martin Short joined, I think joined around like season four, but he was he was a Second City regular at one point. But at one point, I think he had a sitcom with Diana Canova called "I'm a Big Girl Now."
Yes, he was the fourth or fifth down the cast list. I'm a big girl now.
I like that.
And Danny Thomas was the was dad.
So he joined, and of course he was there was instant.
By the way, if you go to Cantor's, don't order the Danny Thomas platter. I'm just going to leave it at that.
I won't.
Did he do Catherine O'Hara on? I mean Catherine O'Hara, Catherine Hepburn on SCTV first.
He did. Yeah,
and he did, and Jackie Rogers Jr. came off of SCTV.
Ed Grimley,
did
Second City stage.
What the hell was Jackie Rogers Jr. like? What was he riffing?
But it was magical.
It was like Edgar Winter and all these like Liza Minnelli and Sammy.
Edgar Winter and Sammy Davis Jr. had a baby.
Yeah.
One of my favorite characters, and this is another Canadian throwback, is Brock Linehan that Martin Short did. And, you know, this was back when the show was on NBC.
What was the Brock?
Brock Linehan?
Was
Brock
it?
Linehan, you know, Stars in One. You, a young, you know, Steve Roman. That guy was real. And Short wasn't doing, except the only difference was that Brian Linehan was a celebrity interviewer in Canada. And he knew he would really dig into your career and know everything. The difference was with Martin Short's character is that he got everything wrong. But it was a scary impersonation of Brian Linehan. And it turns out that Martin Short and him were friends.
Okay. But
there is a bit where Brock Linehan goes home and it's John Candy and him. John Candy is his high school coach who's a priest. Mm-hmm. And all John Candy wants him to do is dribble the basketball.
Oh, that's...
And I dare you not to laugh at this because Candy is...
I know what you're talking about.
Candy's telling Brock Linehan about, you know, your father, you should see the disappointment in his face. What have I done wrong? And he's like, will you please try to sink a basket? And he's like, no. And he's like, please, and he does it, and Candy's on the floor laughing. And it's so funny.
He did another. There were two other things I just thought of, and now I lost one of them. One was Joe Flaherty doing George Plimpton.
Yeah.
No, not Plimpton. I'm sorry.
He did George Plimpton, though.
No, not Plimpton. Oh, my God.
By the way, Guy Caballero is Mengele in Boys from Brazil.
Oh, no, come on. The documentary was just about Gore Vidal had the rivalry with Buckley. William F. Buckley.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And Flaherty would lean back in the chair. I mean, well, I was wondering about the... And he would do this, like, the same cadence as Buckley. And he would almost be, like, falling on the floor. He leaned back so far in the chair. There was that one, and when Moranis did Merv Griffin, like
Merv Griffin.
every 3 seconds he'd do that.
Oh, just I loved Gene Levy's Perry Como.
I don't know if I remember that.
He played Perry Como like a corpse.
We forget. Let's just, you know, because we're going to have to wrap this up in a minute. I'm sorry, folks. We're very busy people. But let's go down. We forget. We're talking about all the stuff that was. Stuff that they were riffing on and stuff that they were spoofing or doing impressions of or whatever. The original stuff, the five nice guys. Five Neat Guys. Give me at least two song titles from Five Neat Guys.
Oh my God. Now that
something about a slut. There's something about so and so.
Yeah, they're always kind of they're like a fist. They're really nasty songs. All I remember of the Five Neat Guys is they're in one of the award shows, and they do a thing. They do a thing where they're doing a review of all the movies, and they do Raiders of the Lost Ark, met a Nazi, and his face melted. That's all I remember. That.
They do. It's like they're all in cardigans, like they're five Bing Crosby singing the nicest, sweetest. Let's go have a malted at the, you know, at the soda fountain or something. And then, like, well, you get to the fourth or fifth song, it's like, you know, Jane is the town slut or something. Or
yeah,
the,
you know what?
Go easy.
I wanted to point out too. You mentioned Duke and Rosato, who were brought in for a few seasons, or, you know, to fill in for John Candy, who had left to do his own show on CTV. But then, towards the end, the show got canceled on NBC because they wanted to move it against 60 Minutes, I think.
Okay.
And they put the show on Showtime, I believe.
Oh, yeah. No, Cinemax.
Cinemax. And yes. A few cast members left. So... I love the Cinemax years. They're weird. They're experimental. They're not quite the same madness, but there's some really, really good humor in that. And they brought in two new players, John Hemphill, who's basically a voiceover guy in Canada a lot.
Yeah, I know that
Mary
name.
Mary Charlotte Wilcox, who I think is a priest now. And John Hemphill, his biggest contribution to the show was they did a series called Happy Hour, which was really very SCTV. It's a kid's show, but it's hosted in a bar, and it's Happy, Sammy the Goose, and Mike, which is Martin Short's brother, Mike the Bartender. And, okay. You know, it's just like a shitty kid's show, and he plays old serials, and Eugene Levy and Martin Short are in the serial with Joe Flaherty. You know, it's like an old Western.
Okay.
And I always loved that Eugene Levy's character's name is Don Mills, which is a road in Toronto, Don Mills Road.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And Mary Charlotte Wilcox played a couple of different characters, but her best one is Idella Vudry, who's just this old biddy. And you know, she was just part of Melonville. And they did some really funny stuff. I think the funniest thing that season does is they do their own version of 2010, A Space Odyssey. But it's basically, it's basically a remake of like Catwoman on the Moon, way before Amazon Women on the Moon did this.
Wow.
And it is Woody Tobias Jr. and Art Garfunkel.
Oh my God, you're kidding me.
But it's wait, Joe Flaherty as Art Garfunkel.
Wasn't there, but see, that's what I'm talking, that's the absurdity.
Oh, it was Ernest Borgnine and Art Garfunkel.
Even better.
Yeah.
That's the absurdity of the characters that they went after, yeah. The impressions that they went after. But wasn't there a thing where Orson Welles like has an argument with Hal, the computer from 2001 or something?
That sounds familiar. That's not. I'll have to look that up.
There was something. It was like it was him and it was Candy and I forget who else was. But So original, you know, Bob and Doug, well, obviously they were spoofing on, you know, the Canadian content, but like a lot of their original stuff, just the whole idea of the network. I mean, Johnny LaRue was never really supposed to.
What a beautiful character he was.
No, but what I'm saying was he ever supposed. That was an original character. That wasn't like spoofing some local guy named LaRue.
Not that I know of. I think it was actually kind of just a. John Candy creation, you know, maybe a
wait a minute,
aggrandizing himself.
The Polynesian Town thing. I thought that was like Merv Griffin and Orson Welles somehow show up in that, and there's something to do with the Hal from 2001 or something. Am I getting stuff mixed up?
Yeah, because I've watched a ton of this lately. Preparing.
Yeah, then you would. Yeah, so. you'd know better.
But I can't remember.
So to me, you know, this show was the best of, you know, whatever the best SNL had to offer. And again, I'm not trying to say if you're an SNL person and you think that's the great, whatever. I always thought that the individuals were greater than the sum. And there are only, and plus the fact that it was live and they were reading off of cards. I never, it always seemed like, that would, you know, then there were the catchphrases and everything else. I never had the affinity for it that I did for SCTV. And like I say, Python sort of came first, but SCTV, you know, at a certain point, you've seen all that Python had to offer on television.
Yeah.
You know, once you'd seen them all, SCTV was like, oh my God, in the wilderness between, you know, understanding as a 9-10 year old that Python was done on television, but then things would come on like the Ruddles, you know, All You Need Is Cash, and different like Ripping Yarns, and things would show up that I'd think, oh yeah. Well, no, that's not
the truth. The Last Polka for SCTV.
Going
Berserk.
So the SCTV thing was, yeah, exactly. Or the two Armed and Dangerous, the two
Armed and Dangerous. They were also in Splash together.
They were in Splash together.
Yeah, yeah, and I would end up seeing all of these things. I saw Armed and Dangerous in the theater.
I think I did too.
Because I just, you know, John Candy and Eugene Levy, this is the best it's going to get.
You know what? I literally haven't thought of this until this moment just now, ever again since it happened. If I'm not mistaken, the two of them showed up on Letterman for Armed and Dangerous.
They actually were supposed to host Saturday Night Live, and it got canceled.
I think they show up on Late Night with David Letterman in like 86 or whatever it was that movie came out. And if I'm right that movie came out in 86, I really need to get another hobby or something, because
it came out in 86 because I got kicked out of a mall for peeing in a.
There's no reason on earth that I should know Armed and Dangerous came out in 86.
You know what's really sad is that I watched it recently, and it's like, oh, I remember this like it was
yesterday. It was a year after. Wasn't Summer Rental like 85?
Summer Rental?
But Candy, what I always read about him, two things that, I'd heard about him. One was that he was the procrastinator of the group, that he was very funny, and he was pretty good at writing stuff, but he would procrastinate up the yin-yang. If it was time to have a, you know, a writing session or whatever, he was terrible at really hankering down. He'd make excuses. He'd go, I'm going to go out and have a cigarette. And then he, you know, he'd be gone for hours or something. And two, that, and I heard this like right around the time that he died or something. If he saw, you know, enough jokes in a script or character stuff that were fat jokes, that was just about, you know, and then he falls in, he's fat and this happens and he eats a big thing, whatever, he wouldn't take the part.
Well, good for him.
And, you know, he started to, you know, and I think it kind of bore that out. Like, if you think about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles or even Uncle Buck and things like that, he found the realness in these characters. And it wasn't just that it was a big, big fat guy.
Yeah.
It just, you know, he was about the character.
Well, my favorite John Candy character ever on SCTV is a character called Paul Fist in Your Face. It's just a nightmare and a bully. I think he's only on like one or two early SCTVs, but seek it out. Carpentry with Paul Fist in Your Face.
Well,
he's like basically a Lenny from Mice and Men. And he wants to build furniture, and he's got Dave Thomas as a sidekick, and Dave Thomas is terrified of him, and he just punches through wood, and he's just like, we're going to make a table, you know, and he smashes stuff, and at one point, Dave Thomas tries to leave, and Candy's Fist in Your Face goes, you're coming back, right? And he's like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? I swear, I'll never forget, for the first time seeing Dr. Tongue and the Midnight Cowboy.
Oh my God.
Their version of Midnight Cowboy. So Dr. Tongue did the 3D House of Beef or 3D House of Cats.
They would always do something that just didn't work. And that was
didn't work. Just something. But Midnight his character, Cowboy. The Dr. Tongue character,
yeah,
was so goddamn funny. But I will never forget this famous scene from Midnight Cowboy where Ratso and Joe Buck are crossing a street,
yeah,
and they almost get by a taxi. What was Levy's character called?
Ratso.
Was it Ratso?
Well, it's Bruno. Yeah, I think he was playing Ratso, but it was Bruno from.
Come here, Bruno. It's come this way,
Bruno. Oh. Yeah,
and frickin' Candy in that fringe jacket, jeans tucked into boots, crossing the street, and I must have been. I couldn't have been more than 13 or 14, but I knew well enough what Midnight Cowboy was.
Yeah, he's a hustler.
Oh, my God.
He's a hustler. My favorite line in that bit is Bruno's basically saying, well, you know, I don't see you getting the babes. And you know, Dr. Tongue gets upset, and Joe Buck gets upset, and he's like, well, I don't see Miss Marianne Mobley running around this.
see, the thing is, to me, all the best stuff, you know, like the stuff that we're talking about, or even the Looney Tunes stuff, you know, when they would talk to those guys and they'd say, did you have a market in mind? Was there an age group in mind? Who were you sort of trying to, you know, pinpoint? No focus groups. Let's put this up the flagpole and see what everyone says, and then we'll change it. They were just doing what made themselves, you know, each other laugh. And they clearly enjoyed working together and, you know, brought out the best in each other.
Well,
but
the other thing is that they were sometimes in fear of getting paid. You know, in Dave Thomas's book, there's all kinds of points where they all stopped work to wait for checks. And so, you know, they are just kind of throwing stuff around. And, the post-SCTV stuff, I can tell you right now, anything in the 80s, those guys did. I can tell you Joe Flaherty has a one-minute scene in Johnny Dangerously.
Oh, my God.
I even had a Joe Flaherty busted pilot with, I think Orson Bean was in it.
Okay, speaking of Orson Bean and all these guys, you know what's a great show, and it might even be on DVD?
What's that?
Is the animated Ed Grimley series.
Okay, that is genius.
It is genius.
The Count Floyd segments in that are hilarious.
Count Floyd, all of a sudden it turns and it's there's a live action thing going on.
Yeah, and there's one show. Count Floyd where he's describing and they're animating his story. Mm-hmm. And then midway through, a kid goes, "This is Scooby-Doo."
Oh my God.
And you look at the characters and it's a guy with a green shirt and a dog and a van. Count Floyd's like, okay, it's Scooby-Doo.
But it's brilliant because it was like, I remember that was right around, I think it was right around Pee-wee's Playhouse that started to come on the air. And I remember, you know, being 15, 16, whatever it was, going, this is not your usual Saturday morning sort of cartoon. I don't know if it ran one or two seasons, but Short did a bunch of voices in it.
Yeah.
I think it ran
a single season, but I taped them. I liked them.
I think Flaherty did multiple voices too, or maybe just...
No, I think you're right. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
I gotta find that. That
I
might
was probably actually... 17 when it came out, so...
Not only might that might be on DVD.
Oh, I think it is.
But also, I think there was at least a talking doll, Ed Grimley doll, pull-string doll
there
that was
no
made.
There was no talking Count Floyd doll, so I was...
Now, you just recently put something up on... put a notice up somewhere about us saying, every time I talk to Lindsay with a show, like, he makes me spend money. Yeah. Well, now I'm going to have to go away from this show and not only get... because I've got one volume of SCTV. I should have all
I have
the
DVDs. Them all. They sold them cheap here.
I should get those and... Let's track down the Ed Grimley animated series, and I got to get that talking doll.
You also need Grimley Halloween costume.
Yes, that's right.
And you know what they did, and I wish I still had them, was when SCTV came back into syndication around the 94.
Okay.
I remember I rented my first place.
Okay.
And my roommate brought me the paper, and in the paper were cutout masks of Count Floyd.
No.
And I think Dr. Tongue, and I lost my marbles. You know, it was, and I don't know what happened to them.
No, listen, I promise you, we're going to hang up here and you're going to go Google, because I promise you, somebody else out there is as obsessive as you and has saved those things, and I'll bet you can, like, somehow get them somehow.
They're probably worth, you know, $8-$9, but.
I would take those, though. I would take those, and then I would print a bunch. So I could actually cut them out and use them for...
I remember they brought me a lot of joy. like I said, I planned college courses around when SCTV was playing. I watched it every day religiously for years, so...
Yeah, I just... It's what's nice about it is, and odd at the same time, is this one set of DVDs that I have, mm-hmm. that I've been sort of tucking into, you know? I bet I haven't seen these shows in... over 20 years. I can't think of
them.
I don't think how I could have seen them in the last 20 years or so, because I don't think I had.
Yeah, there's some stuff that was cut for syndication, like Vikings and Beekeepers. And
you can see some stuff that's they're clearly picking, you know, from like 76, 77 and sticking in the show and stuff. The newer stuff, you know. It's amazing how I'll be in the middle of watching one and go like, oh my God, I know exactly what's about to happen. I haven't seen this in 25 years, is probably where this thing is going to go. And then the bulk of it is like beautiful sort of surprises, just going, oh, wow, what a great thing to rediscover that. It's been so long. So
yeah. We should also just point out one thing. One of the successes of SCTV is the ladies.
Oh,
never before were,
never.
Were women able to shine as powerfully as SCTV. I mean, I know that SNL had Gilda and Jane, but... You know, this was a tour de force for Andrea Martin and Catherine O'Hara, and they were practically in every scene.
You know, and the thing they did too was they the thing is, not to take anything away from, you know, Gilda did more character stuff, but not to take anything away from Jane Curtin and Lorraine Newman, you know, people like that, a lot of the SNL stuff over the years and the women that have come off there and stuff. You know, these Andrea Martin and Catherine O'Hara, they inhabited characters. And the only thing I can see close to, like, I think that Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Louise Dreyfus, is one of the funniest humans in history. And what she did, not only on Seinfeld, but on Veep, which is to just not care what kind of mud you get on your face and just be completely funny, it's still not the same thing as what those two did. And the only person I can think that kind of comes close is Amy Poehler. if you look at, there's a great, this is a few years ago, somebody put up, like, there are all these Polaroids that were taken on set with each character she did during Upright Citizens Brigade, the sketch show.
Yeah.
And they were just, every one of them was a completely different person. She'd do male, female, kid, old lady. That's what those two did, as far as I'm concerned. And no one could touch the two of them. And Catherine O'Hara is still, like, the funniest human on the planet, practically.
Yeah, she's
just genius. You don't see enough
of Andrea Martin.
She's still doing stuff. I mean, she's in stuff.
I saw Andrea Martin on stage a few years ago, Young Frankenstein. It was magical. Getting back to
Gene Wilder. Oh,
wow. Yeah.
Wow, see, it all comes back to Gene Wilder.
Yeah. And
you just mentioned Gilda Radner. And
who's your favorite SCTV cast member, if you have to pick? Just we'll end on that.
Well, I got to tell you, for the longest time, like when I was a kid, it was Joe Flaherty.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what it was about him that I just, he just.
Because he was the hardest worker.
And he was just kind of manic, yeah.
Yeah, I love Joe Flaherty. He's not the shining star.
No.
He's the glue in everything.
He totally is. Yeah. And then I would have said Dave Thomas. But as the years have gone on, and this is only because he didn't do as much stuff at the time, Martin Short. I think Martin Short, and I say this from just as a person, not as a – his stuff that he did on the show was different than what the rest of them kind of – because he came in kind of later and his stuff was kind of –
He had
a different kind of energy. But I'm telling you, man, I have seen him, whether it's a morning show, like a Today Show kind of thing for 5 minutes, or it is, you know, a live thing like Billy on the Street, something live. And he just, when he is thrown stuff, and from inside information I have, let's just say, for the sketch show, I think the variety show he was doing with what's her name on NBC or something. And I heard this horrible story about this day-long shoot, this 10-hour thing that just went on and on and on, and like just for a promo. And they said he's like the most affable guy in the world, but he was starting to get irritated because it was like, in a nutshell, he was looking around going, I can't believe how many people there are here, how long this is taking, how much money, etc. And this is what I've been given to say. And when what's more, when he was sort of, well, we need you to do this, we need you, he was like, he started to get kind of angry. He was like, you know, I just want a point of view. Someone needs to have a point of view and tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it. And the guy just, you know, I can understand that because nothing can throw this guy. Like everything I've ever seen him do, and I think the most recent thing was maybe it was Steve Colbert or something, who I don't really care for now because I hate that show. But he just steals whatever moment he's in. He is just the funniest person and the funniest energy in the room. And I think his brain is just always going, kind of like mine. We're very much alike, I think. And we're both short, so I think we'd get along. No, I'm kidding. Who would be your favorite?
Flaherty.
Flaherty, right? It's,
yeah.
It is, isn't
it? Seconded by Dave Thomas, because I love Dave Thomas.
Do you know what it is? I think.